Our next case is Apple et al. Versus Catherine Vidal, Director of the Patent Office, 2022-1249. Morning, Ms. Carroll.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. The FINTIV rule unlawfully restricts access to IPR for precisely the class of petitioners that Congress understood would have needed it the most, that is, petitioners that have been accused in litigation of infringing questionable patents. Now, judicial review is presumptively available to review challenges to allegedly unlawful agency rules. So although the district court correctly rejected the director's standing arguments, it erred in dismissing this case under Section 314D. That decision violates decades of settled precedent holding that a statute that precludes review of a specified agency determination does not bar review of an agency rule that governs those decisions. And in that respect, this case, I think, is indistinguishable from the Supreme Court's decision in Bowen, which we rely on in our briefs.
That was not a non-enforcement case.
Bowen was a reviewability by statute.
I guess I'd like you to focus more on the committed to agency discretion piece. I don't want to engage with whether 314D goes beyond its language in some way to make 701A1 applicable to things that are other than the individual determination. So I guess that, for me at least, I'm very focused on the fact that this is a non-enforcement decision, and Bowen is not that.
That's certainly correct. Bowen, you're right, goes more to the 701A1 issue. I think the district court's decision clearly contradicts Bowen and the DACA decision as to that point. As to 701A2, the question whether this is agency action committed to discretion by law, we think we have a very strong case that provision does not preclude review here for a few reasons. As this court and the Supreme Court and other courts have explained, that provision applies very narrowly only in the rare circumstances where there is no law to apply. And I think it's helpful to consider that provision with respect to each of the counts in our complaint
each. I see the argument about and it's not just no law to apply. I think the court has not said it's limited only to that. There are certain categories, in particular non-enforcement action, which certainly overlap with the no law to apply. But and I do think that there's something to the notion that for your APA 5 U.S.C. 553 notice and comment rulemaking argument that is not one of those. And indeed, in Lincoln against Vigil, the court reviewed the notice and comment rulemaking claim, and the government, in fact, included a footnote in its brief that said, we understand that's not one of the committed to agency discretion by law things, because 553 supplies the law to apply, and that's also not a non-enforcement decision. But what about your two substantive challenges to a rule, if that's what one wants to call it, and I don't mean anything technical by it, that simply says, we have discretion, or rather the director says, I have discretion, I delegated that discretion to the board, and here are a list of non-exclusive considerations that will guide how you as my delegee will exercise the discretion. What's the case law that you have cited for why that is, that kind of enumeration of discretionary considerations is itself not committed to agency discretion?
So I want to provide the case law and explain why we think it's on our side, and I also want to address how the rule here operates and why we think it's within that case law, because I think we would characterize it slightly differently than Your Honor just did. Maybe taking that last part first, sort of as the premise of the application of the cases. The FINTIV rule here is not simply a list of factors that the board must consider. I think even if that's all it were, to be clear, I think our case would be reviewable anyway. But it goes much farther than that. It is a list of factors combined with direction to the board about you must consider these factors when you find this factor, it weighs this direction. When you find this factor, it weighs the other direction. And when the sum total of those factors indicate that conducting IPR would be quote unquote inefficient in light of the litigation, that leads to denial. So to take an example, I think the board's application of the rule in the Supercell institution decision, which we cite at 16 to 17 of our opening brief, is a really good example of...
The Supreme Court case is about non-enforcement. You know, Heckler against Cheney is kind of the seminal one or something. But Lincoln talks about this as well.
Right. So I think the...
Please do not interrupt.
I apologize, Your Honor.
So they say there are obvious choices about how to give priority to what agency resources should be used and a number of other things that are absolutely traditional non-enforcement considerations at the heart of discretion of non-enforcement. How does this go beyond that?
So I believe the Supreme Court's decisions in Heckler, in Weyerhaeuser, this court's decision in In re Vivint, the controlling circuit precedent in the Ninth Circuit and the Perez decision, all cited in the briefs, make clear a few key propositions that we rely on here. One is that mere discretion, including non-enforcement discretion, doesn't suffice where the statute being implemented sets clear boundaries, which is our allegation here. And of course, the merits are not at issue here. Our claim on the merits is the statute prohibits the director from denying institution based on the pendency of parallel litigation. And that provides the metric against which the court evaluates the exercise or articulation of discretion. Just as in, for example, in Weyerhaeuser, in Vivint, considering the comparable language in 325D, where this court said even that express grant of discretion did not trigger 701A2, because there are statutory limits. And as even Heckler recognizes, even in the non-enforcement context, if there is a statutory constraint, that constraint is enforceable. And I guess maybe a different way to think of it.
Counsel, on justiciability as opposed to jurisdiction, why isn't there a lack of particularity about whether your clients will be subject to this FINTIV rule? I know you argued that they have in the past, but the future is speculative, isn't it?
In this case, with respect, I think looking to the allegations of the complaint, it's not speculative. We've alleged, first of all, a clear pattern of past applications of the rule, along with specific allegations that these plaintiffs regularly develop technologies, that they are regularly subject to infringement claims in litigation, that they routinely file IPR petitions in that context, that the board is obligated by law to apply the rule to petitions filed in that context, that there are pending petitions.
And you can raise that issue when there's a denial.
The board does not entertain those arguments because it understands that it is obligated by the rule and it cannot deviate from the rule. And this court has also held that no appeal from a denial is available on this basis. And so I think this is a critical point that cuts through both the standing argument and the justiciability arguments, which is that if this suit is precluded, the consequence is that there is no avenue available for any rule governing institution of IPR, not on appeal, not on mandamus, not under the APA. You could have a new director come in who just makes a naked policy substitution. I don't know what Congress was thinking in creating IPR. I just think it's a bad idea. From now on, the board should deny all IPR petitions unless they're filed within 30 days after service of a complaint. I think it would be quite clear that such a rule would violate the AIA. But under the director's position, that rule would be unenforceable. It reads Section 314D as well as the standing and other justiciability principles.
It's your position that a writ of mandamus would not be able to be brought to this court, and why not?
So this court held in Mylan that mandamus would be available to review a denial only in the case of a colorable constitutional claim, and the director has taken that position as well. So that really does leave the APA as the only available route, which is what the Supreme Court said in Quoso and SAS and adhered to in Thrive, that 314D and the statute in general does not enable the PTO to act outside its statutory authority. I guess I would look at it this way. Suppose you had a provision in the AIA that explicitly said the director may not deny institution based on the pendency of parallel litigation. I don't want to speak for the government, but I would assume that they would agree that the FINTIV rule would be unlawful if that's what the statute explicitly said, and that courts are available, as they presumptively are in the absence of clear and convincing contrary evidence, to enforce the statute against the director's unlawful rule.
What you just said scans very easily on 701A1. But 701A2, what you just said, would be clearly inapplicable to that, because that would not be committed to agency discretion. And there's a body of D.C. Circuit law, which you did not cite, that talks about the kind of exception to committed to agency discretion by law where the statutory violation is particularly clear. I don't really see that you're in that ballpark, and you haven't argued that you're in that ballpark. You're making an argument that the statutory structure, the statutory policy, the practicalities make this a really bad fit for this regime.
So, Your Honor, we haven't made that argument here because it goes more to the merits, but we did make that argument in our summary judgment briefing below. I'm about to cross into my rebuttal time, but if I could provide an answer to the question. We do think that this is effectively that same situation for a few reasons in the text, structure, and context and purposes of the statute. We have, first of all, Section 315B that sets the one-year period, implicitly acknowledging and permitting IPR petitions in the wake of an infringement assertion in court, provided they're timely. We have the sort of traffic control measures in 315A, which explicitly dictate the circumstances in which the pendency of an infringement claim in litigation does or does not preclude IPR from going forward. We have other provisions related to parallel proceedings before the office, as opposed to litigation, where Congress expressly conferred discretion on the director to handle parallel proceedings in his or her discretion. Those provisions would be totally superfluous if the statute allowed something like the FINTIV rule. So we have all of those provisions together in light of the purpose of IPR in the first place, which is to make a more efficient, streamlined procedure for challenging questionable patents available precisely when those patents have been asserted in litigation. So we think very much, again, this is a merits question, and for jurisdictional justiciability purposes, of course, the court takes the merits as they come. But on the merits, we think there's a very strong case that, in fact, this rule does exceed the guardrails around the director's discretion in exactly the way that was true in the cases that Your Honor is referring to. And granted, the director disagrees with our reading of the statute. And if the complaint is reinstated as it should be, the district court will have to resolve that dispute about statutory interpretation. Does the statute prohibit this rule or doesn't it? But that's exactly why there is law to apply here. And there is a metric against which to measure the director's exercise of discretion here. This is not a case like this court's decision in Allman Brothers, for instance, which was another 701A2 case, where the issue was that the U.S. trade representative could accept certain trade benefits that the secretary deemed satisfactory. The court has no way to decide whether something should or shouldn't be satisfactory to an agency. But a court certainly has the ability to interpret a statute, decide whether a rule violates the statute, decide whether the agency engaged in reasoned decision-making as required by the APA, and of course, as I think Your Honor mentioned earlier, the notice and comment claim wouldn't be subject to the 701A2 objection at all because agencies have no discretion not to follow those required procedures. Unless the court has...
As you notice, your time has expired, but we'll give you back your rebuttal time.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Mr. Shaw.
May it please the court. Whaley Shaw for Director Vidal. As the Supreme Court and this court have held, Congress gave the director unreviewable discretion to deny institution of IPR. The politically accountable director could exercise that discretion herself without any explanation based on considerations she holds only in her head. And we would not be here today if she had done that. However, the director has delegated that authority to the board, and the previous director, in an act of transparency and good governance, gave his subordinates written instructions about things they should think about when exercising his discretion, that is, the FINTIV factors. Now, the plaintiffs have already come to this court multiple times making the same arguments that they are making now. But this court has...
Can I interrupt you? I really would like to have your response to Ms. Carroll's hypothetical about what if there was a statute that said, you cannot choose to not institute because of the existence of parallel district court litigation, and then the PTO had the FINTIV factors anyway, so that it was a clear statutory violation. Would there be judicial review, and how so?
Well, I think that if it were true that there was some clear statutory command governing the director's discretion to deny institution, then the case law would look completely different. For example, this court's decision in Mylan would not have held that mandamus is not available except for colorable constitutional claims because there are essentially no statutory limits on the director's discretionary denial authority. This court and the Supreme Court have both said that the director can deny review for basically any reason. In Mylan, this pointed out, this court said that the Supreme Court had determined in Quozo that the institution decision is committed to agency discretion by law. So I think this court's precedent and the Supreme Court's precedent indicate that it is not the case that there are any clear statutory limitations on the director's denial authority, which just goes to show how inappropriate it is for the plaintiffs to come back to this court again, making the same arguments that they have in previous cases that have been rejected, but now doing so by a more circuitous route. So they recognize...
I'm not sure that that's really a fair characterization. I mean, maybe in the district court, to the extent that the plaintiffs were arguing there are statutory constraints, maybe of a less than express and directly applicable sort, but nevertheless enough statutory constraints you may be right that that's inconsistent on the merits with the assertion, with the premises of a number of our decisions and the Supreme Court's Arthrex and Quozo about discretion. But in this court, all they're asking for is an opportunity to argue about that.
Right. So what they are asking, let's start with the district court example, or let's start with the final written.
Just be clear, sure. We don't have any case that involves an attack on a director or otherwise PTO authoritative generic pronouncement about how to go about making the yay or nay institution decision. All of our cases are about individual determinations, right?
I think you're referring to cases interpreting the preclusion of review with respect to inter partes.
Do we have any cases that involve attacks on generic director or otherwise authoritative pronouncements about the standards that will apply to the yay or nay institution decision?
I certainly am not aware of any in the IPR context, and I think there's a good reason for that because the director's decision to deny institution is akin to the enforcement discretion that was discussed in Heckler. And those decisions are made as a matter of discretion, are traditionally unreviewable, and are based on factors that are up to the politically accountable decision makers.
Is it your position that whenever an individual case-specific determination is committed to agency discretion, that an agency's pronouncements about how that discretion will be exercised in the future are thereby also committed to the agency's discretion?
I certainly don't think that it's possible to draw any sort of bright line rule, but I think in this case, if you look at the design of the statutory scheme, the purposes of insulating the denial decision from the institution decision from judicial review, this court's precedents and the Supreme Court's precedents discussing the unreviewability of those determinations, I think it's clear that
the answer you're giving right now,
yes,
I think, would require you to say what about Judge Stoll's example of a very clear statutory constraint on the exercise of that discretion.
Well, I think that would be a very different decision. So, for example, if that were the case, I would imagine that in my land, this court would not have said that there is no mandamus review for statutory claims, only for colorable constitutional claims. And perhaps this court, you know, the Supreme Court would not have said that the denial decision is committed to agency discretion by law. But that is, in fact, what the courts have said. So I guess it's hard to sort of generalize about this or hard to sort of discuss this hypothetical because it would mean that the entire case law, all the case law and understandings of the statute would be different.
Well, let's set that case law aside and say it doesn't exist and this is the first case before us. What would be your answer? Hypothetical.
Yeah, I guess I suppose it's hard to say. I mean, I suppose if there were an absolutely clear statutory command and the director were clearly violating it, then maybe, you know, the mandamus review would be something that this court might consider. And it would depend on how clear the statutory command would be. And, you know, all of the sort of discretionary decisions that go into the grant of mandamus review. So I think that would present a very different situation.
Why is the 553 claim not reviewable?
I think
and you mean 701A1, 701A2, both.
I think it's clearly incompatible with the statutory scheme because, again, this is a scheme that allocates unreviewable discretion to the director, allows her, she could be making...
Why is this different from Lincoln? In Lincoln, the Indian Health Service had said, we have under a lump sum appropriation, unreviewable discretion about how to spend it. And the Supreme Court said first, yes, you're quite right about that. Substantively unreviewable discretion, because the nature of a lump sum appropriation is we're not constraining how you spend it. But then the Supreme Court went on to decide on the merits the question of whether the exercise of that discretion to cancel a particular program and reallocate funds was in fact subject to review for whether it needed to be done by notice and comment rulemaking. And in a footnote in your brief in that case, you said, quite right, there is of course law to apply to that decision, namely the process for going about making the decision, the law being specifically 553 and its standards. You probably won that issue, but that's a merits victory.
Right. I think the answer is that a claim that notice and comment rulemaking is required to determine what the director may consider in exercising her unreviewable discretion to deny institution of IPR is fundamentally incompatible with the statutory scheme. I mean, just imagine what would happen if the director were exercising that authority herself, which she does sometimes do through director review decisions. I mean, would she have to sort of, would she be required if she has some considerations that she thinks about in her head and she intends to consistently apply across cases, would she be required to then solicit notice and comment? I mean, this type of claim.
Well, what's distinctive here is that the issuance, this precedential opinion, binds her 250 delegees in their exercise of the delegated authority. So this is not just in an individual decision maker's head. It's a binding proclamation. I'm just trying to avoid APA words here.
Right.
That governs her delegee's exercise of authority.
And she is plainly permitted to instruct her subordinates as to how to exercise her discretion. She can issue a memo. She can designate a precedential decision. She can undertake, she can review, she has the authority to review institution decisions herself. And so she has a range of methods by which she can exercise her management authority over the board, the board's exercise of her discretion. And so the idea that her choice among these methods could be dictated, particularly when she could have exercised the discretion herself, I think is just incompatible with the statutory scheme. I would just...
So can I, just to make sure I understand, yeah. You're saying her discretion is so vast that even the procedure under which she should be making the exercising that discretion is outside of court review. Is that what you're saying?
I think it is clear in the statutory scheme that the director has the ability to deny institution for any constitutionally permissible reason. And I think efforts by the courts to dictate to the director what factors she may or may not consider in exercising...
Just think about procedure. Let's set aside the factors. You're talking about merits now. I'm going back to Judge Toronto's questions about the procedure and notice and comment rulemaking. So I'm trying to understand. I thought I was repeating back to you what I understood you to be saying. So could you focus just on the notice and comment rulemaking?
I think that is correct, that it would intrude on the director's ability to exercise the unreviewable discretion granted to her by statute that Congress intended for her to be able to have.
Even for her to be able to determine not just what the factors are, but unfettered abilities on how she's going to determine.
I don't know if there's some procedural way of exercising her authority that would be so outside the bounds of constitutional permissibility that there would be a claim there. But certainly this type of claim that, you know, she has to set out her factors by notice and comment rulemaking is not consistent with the statute. I also want to sort of turn to the idea that this is the factors are binding or that dictate results in particular cases. And I think that
those maybe do very different things. In fact, they are obviously very different things.
Yeah, I think that's right.
It is binding to consider the factors with some arrows attached to the factors.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Furthermore, the idea that plaintiffs can be sure of how these factors are going to be applied is entirely speculative. I would just point out that on pages 3 and 4 of their reply brief, plaintiffs cite, I think, 5 pending IPR petitions, or that were pending at the time the reply brief was written. Now, I looked into some of those, or into the ones that are cited.
Standing now?
Yes, but I think this also speaks to a broader question of sort of the speculative nature of plaintiffs' efforts to indicate how you're right, Honor. I mean, I think this answer mostly goes to standing. Out of those decisions, every single one has already an institution decision has been made in each one of those cases, and in none of those cases did the board rely on the FINTIF factors. There was always some other basis for the decision. And so the idea that the FINTIF factors are certainly going to cause harm to them is, I think, again, entirely speculative and not sufficient to support standing. And I think that goes to sort of a more general problem with the plaintiff's case, which is that it's absolutely clear that they cannot, on review of a final written, they cannot attack a decision applying the FINTIF factors in a particular case. And so at least in that case, it would be clear for standing purposes, whether the FINTIF factors will be applied, you know, what the potential effects of the decision are. But they can't do that because Congress has made the judgment that that review is not allowed. Now what they want to do is sort of shift to an earlier point in the process when it's still very unclear whether the factors will be applied to them or not. And in that, that's where they run up against the standing problem. So by trying to sort of shift away from attacking individual decisions and relying on their injuries from particular denials of IPR and trying to sort of attack the scheme as a whole, you know, they are changing their problem from a preclusion of review problem to a standing problem. We contend that preclusion of review governs in every the statute of preclusion of review governs both types of claims, but according to them, even if you accept their preclusion of review argument, they still face the standing argument up front, and that's something that they can't get around because Congress has precluded
maybe
them.
Maybe you can help me understand this a little bit more precisely. I at least coming in the way I was thinking about this, that just focus on Apple. It's not clear to me this is true of all five plaintiffs, but Apple has been a defendant, patent infringement defendant, in a vast number of suits, continuing as far as we know, has been an IPR petitioner in a vast number of matters. Why is it unduly speculative that particularly maybe, or maybe this is irrelevant, maybe this is unnecessary, but particularly in light of at least there being some numbers of FINTIV-based denials of institution, that Apple would be adversely affected, even though sitting here today, it cannot almost by definition identify the particular instance? Why is that not enough for standing?
Yeah, so I have at least two responses that I'd like to get out. The first is just that the probability is not as high as they say, especially since the FINTIV factors are, the FINTIV factors themselves remain the same. The director has, in the exercise of her politically accountable discretion, clarified the application of the FINTIV factors in particular cases. So, for example, now a compelling showing of success on compelling showing of likelihood of success on the merits allows you to get around the FINTIV factors. That is, that they would not.
So is this moot as to the challenge to the FINTIV factors?
We're not contending that it's moot, but I'm just saying that the application of the factors it may depend on, for example, interim guidance that's been issued by the director on director review decisions that sort of clarify how the factors should be applied. But
and there has not yet been an announcement about the idea floated last spring or summer about conducting a rulemaking. Is that right?
The rulemaking, the director has requested comments, has not yet issued.
Requested comments about whether to propose
right.
a rule?
Right. There has not been a notice of proposed rulemaking. That's correct. But the director has issued interim guidance about how the FINTIV factors should be applied. They include, for example, the rule I indicated about compelling showing of likelihood of success on the merits. And the final point is just that the idea that you can say I expect, because I have so much litigation going on, I expect to be injured. There's a high probability I will be injured in some case. That is not the kind of showing that the Supreme Court has said is sufficient. In the Summers case, the plaintiff organization made this very kind of argument. There was a regulation governing logging in national forests, and the plaintiff organization said, I have so many men, I have thousands and thousands of members. They live all over the country. They visit national forests all the time. So they are certain to be, they are statistically certain to be impacted by this regulation. What the Supreme Court said is that is not enough. There may be a statistical probability that some harm will occur, but you need to be specific. You need to say which plaintiff visiting which forest at what time.
I don't remember the court's decision, but that at least had the organizational aspect, so it would be fair to say that it was speculative as to any individual member of the organization. Is that right? And here we don't have that issue. We have, just focusing on Apple, a single company that's been sued in hundreds of
Right, to be sure, right. We have a limited number of plaintiffs, but they still need to be, so even beyond showing which member, they need to say, well, what forest are you planning to visit? When are you planning to visit?
There's only one forest. It's the PTO.
No, but the analogy here, I think, is that plaintiffs need to be able to show, well, which IPR petitions are likely to have they need to meet the statutory minimum criteria for institution. Then it has to be likely that the FINTIF factors will be applied to them. It has to be likely that the FINTIF factors will actually be dispositive of institution. And that was the point that I was speaking to earlier with regard to the five cases cited in the reply brief, in which none of those cases had the FINTIF factors applied to them in a dispositive way.
There's a part of Summers that I just want to ask you about. There is at least one particular member of the organization, Matarosian, I think it is, who said that they had repeatedly visited a particular place, PTO, that they had imminent plans to do so again, and that they had interests in viewing the flora and fauna of the area, and those would be harmed if the project went forward. And in that case, the government conceded that that was sufficient to establish Article III standing. So your characterization of the case troubles me, because at least for somebody who, to me, sounds a little bit like some of the parties here, that was conceded by the government and not considered. The court didn't consider that any further than what I've just said.
So first, I think I was referring to sort of the second part of Summers. So if you look down from that portion of the opinion, you'll see the discussion I was talking about. But with regard to the particular plaintiff, I think that plaintiff made a standing showing that the plaintiffs in this case have not made. He said, yes, I am the plaintiff. I am planning to visit this specific forest, which is in fact subject, has a logging or timber project plan for it that is specifically covered by the regulation. So it was absolutely clear.
Your view is that that is more concrete.
Yes, absolutely.
Expect I'll be filing petitions, and I expect that they will be denied based on the FINTIF factors, based on my experience in the past.
Right, just a general experience. I have lots of petitions. Based on the sheer number of petitions, I'm sure as a statistical matter that I am going to be injured. I think that is the kind of showing that is not sufficient under Summers to establish standing.
Thank you, counsel. I think we have your argument. Ms. Carroll, you may have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to try to make, I think, 3 points and answer any additional questions as well. The first thing I want to underscore is that we are not challenging a determination whether to institute an IPR. We are challenging an agency rule governing that decision that we allege on the merits does violate a clear command of the statute. I believe Mr. Shaw conceded that if it were sufficiently clear, that would be a reviewable contention. And the question whether or not that's in fact what this statute means is a question to be determined by the district court on the merits. It does not preclude reviewability. Judge Toronto, you asked if there are any cases out there, whether I think in the 701A1 or the 701A2 context, that say if specific decisions, whether it's a non-enforcement decision or some other specific decision is unreviewable, has a court ever said that makes a general rule unreviewable? And the answer to that, I'm pretty sure, is no. The director hasn't cited any such cases, and I'm not aware of any. And I think the reason for that is because taking that approach would work a sea change in the presumption of reviewability, which is a cornerstone of the idea that agencies are creatures of statute. And when an agency even when an agency has a broad channel of discretion, when that discretion has guardrails around it that Congress has imposed, we expect that the agency will comply with those limits and that courts are available when those limits provide a judicially manageable standard against which to measure the exercise of discretion, which is true here plainly with respect to the notice and comment claim, but with respect to the other claims as well. Mr. Shaw also relied, I think, a good deal on the general statutory structure and purpose here, and the whole idea that Congress wanted this to be, a hands-off, the director just gets to decide this with no limit on discretion whatsoever. And I think it's important in that regard to bear in mind what Congress would have expected about how the director would make rules as opposed to decide individual institution cases. And I think the additional views of the panel in Facebook against Windy City are very helpful in this regard. Congress authorized, expressly authorized, the director to make rules governing institution and IPR, and specifically how IPR would relate to other proceedings. That's in Section 316A4. Congress said, you can make those rules, and the way that you will make those rules is by prescribing regulations. Congress also said, when you make a specific determination in an individual case whether to institute an individual IPR, that institution decision is unreviewable. But there is no reason to think that in doing that, Congress would have ever thought that that would make general rules unreviewable, because Congress would never have thought that the director would make rules by this mechanism in the first place. As the members explained in Facebook versus Windy City, the PTO, neither the director nor the board, have authority to make rules through adjudication.
Can I just ask you, I don't have it in front of me, but does the 316 provision about rulemaking, is it your view that it does apply even when the matter would be within an exception to 553?
So I believe those are perhaps separate questions. I think of 316 as a grant of authority to promulgate regulations. And I think of Section 553 as a rule about how those regulations must be made. And of course, the applicability of 553 turns on what particular type of rule it is, of course. And so you could imagine, I mean, Mr. Shaw talked about all sorts of other ways the director might have exercised discretion or decided how discretion should be exercised.
I guess I'm curious about, in the rulemaking part of Lincoln against Civil, the government wins that on the basis of the exception to 553BA, and Lincoln quotes Chrysler Corp as an exception for statements issued by an agency to advise the public prospectively of the manner in which the agency proposes to exercise a discretionary power. Those words have a certain resonance for what's going on here.
So respectfully, we would disagree with that, and this again goes to the merits of our complaint rather than reviewability up front. But as to the merits and as to that point, what we've argued in the district court is that this is a substantive rule that is subject to notice and comment requirements under the APA, because not only is it binding on the board, but it has legal and practical consequences for regulated parties as well. It's not just direction to the board about how to proceed. It's direction to the board about how to proceed that has legal consequences for parties. And it's the same legal consequences that give our clients standing to bring this complaint. Most standing arguments are generally in the form of, these are the wrong plaintiffs, or not yet, or something along those lines. The standing argument here, I think, is sort of another version of the idea that the discretion the director has here is so completely unreviewable that no court could step in, even if an exercise of that discretion embodied in a rule binding on the board contradicted a clear statutory command. I don't think that's correct, and I think that if this court were to endorse that theory, it would go quite at odds with any decision of the Supreme Court, prior decisions of this court, or the other regional circuits. I mean, going back to Bowen, the Supreme Court traces the presumption of reviewability back to Marbury versus Madison. This is not a technical innovation of the APA. This is a fundamental principle that agencies are expected to follow the law. And when they are alleged not to, and when the court has a manageable standard against which to judge whether the agency has violated the law, that's a reviewable complaint. We may or may not win at the end of the day. I think we have very good arguments that we will win as to all three of the claims, given the irrationality of the rule and given the fact that it cuts off access to IPR in exactly the situation where Congress understood that it would be most necessary and most useful. But those are merits questions. As to whether this is reviewable, this is a bread and butter APA case challenging an allegedly unlawful agency rule. And these plaintiffs have not only, I think we're not relying on a statistical probability that the rule is going to be applied to us. I think of this case as closer to the D.C. Circuit's recent decision in Jibril, which was the terrorist watch list case that's discussed in the briefs, where plaintiffs had a demonstrated past pattern of engaging in certain travel. They plausibly alleged an intention to engage in that travel again, and the court said that was enough. Mr. Shaw said, we can't show for certain that any specific petition would be denied. We're not required to show that. The standard here is substantial likelihood.
I think we have your argument.
Thank you so much.
And we'll take the case under submission.
Thank you.